Hey, Unnaturalists, I'm Andy.
And I'm Ryan.
And welcome back to Unnatural, an unnaturally early spring edition of Unnatural, I would say. Isn't that the case for you? At least here in South Dakota, it is.
Yeah, it was like 70 degrees today. I was wearing sandals and a tank top.
It's one of those things where I love it, but secretly I feel guilty for loving it because I'm worried as to why it's so warm out.
Oh, two things can exist at the same time. You can appreciate and not take for granted that you can go outside, get some fresh air, get some vitamin D going.
Yeah.
And maybe kill some of that winter depression that we have allowed to creep in.
Right.
But you're allowed to be uneasy. You should be uneasy. That's not normal. And California just had a blizzard.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say you're right. I'm happily uneasy right now. Which is kind of
happy?
Maybe.
And hesitant, but appreciative.
And that's kind of the theme of the podcast today, because it does end with justice. However, there's definitely an uneasy feeling that comes along with this. We've covered several cases that have gone cold over the years, and many of these appear to have little or no chance of ever being solved. However, let this case be a reminder that while decades may pass and hope might fade, there's always a chance that a cold case could be solved. For that's exactly what happened with this case. In fact, to my knowledge, Ryan, this is the coldest case ever solved, at least in the history of the U.S. Back in April of 1960, a beauty queen went missing in southern Texas, and tragically, her lifeless body was found just a few short days later, floating in a canal. While it only took a matter of days to find her, the investigation as to who her assailant was lasted over 50 years, leading many in the area to question whether a larger conspiracy and cover-up was at play. This is the story of the murder of Irene Garza and the justice that was brought to her killer 57 years later. Today, Ryan, we are heading to the very southern tip of the U.S. in McAllen, Texas. We're going to a city that straddles the U.S.-Mexico border and the Rio Grande River. That's where Irene Garza was born and raised. She was born in 1934, and her parents, Nicholas and Josefina, owned a dry cleaning business in the city. It was a working class family, and like many families of that time, the Garzas worked their way up from a modest middle class home to a wealthy home. This was an era when the American economy was booming, and the Garzas moved from the south side of McAllen to the city's more affluent north side, as their dry cleaning business really had taken off. It sounds like Irene was an outgoing teenager. She was a twirler, a drum major, and she was the leader of the school's marching band, becoming the first... Yeah, she was actually the first Latina in the school's history to do so.
Hell yeah.
After graduation, she went to college for teaching, and she also became a beauty queen. And in 1958, Irene was crowned Miss All South Texas Sweetheart, along with homecoming queen at Pan American College in the town of Edinburgh, which is a nearby suburb of McAllen. Once she finished college, Irene became a second grade school teacher at a local elementary school, primarily teaching impoverished kids who sometimes barely spoke English. Irene was bilingual, and this came in very handy in southern Texas as there was a large immigrant population. Despite being a beauty queen, a homecoming queen, and an all-around standout, it is said that Irene was actually quite introverted, telling a friend shortly before her disappearance that while she was more or less shy, she had great fulfillment from her job, and she loved teaching kids. She was also quickly moving up the ranks at the school too, becoming secretary of the local parent teacher association. And if you think about this day and age, it wasn't easy for women to work their way up the ranks.
She was doing more for her time than most other people had access to. She's a female, she's Latina, and she's making all of these achievements, and that's really powerful for 1958.
Yeah. And it sounds like her parents were very proud of her. And she also took her faith very seriously. She was a devout Catholic and was reported by friends and family to be a woman who would attend Mass almost daily, reaffirming her faith through the act of communion. Irene was 25 years old at the time, and she was actually still living with her parents as she was not yet married. And in those days, as ridiculous as it sounds now, it was thought to be unbecoming of a woman to live on her own. A little different time period.
I mean, women couldn't have their own bank account until like 1970-something.
Right. Isn't that crazy?
It grosses me out when I actually think of in the span of time that change has happened. It's not been that long. Like, we treat it like it was forever ago, and it's been a blip, but I digress.
So it was April 16th, 1960, the day before Easter, a very important holiday for the Catholic faith, and she told her mother and father that she wanted to give confession at church that evening, and she headed out to their parish, Sacred Heart Church in McAllen. It was said that although Irene was a modest person, she was aware of her beauty and how others looked at her, which often made her uncomfortable. And because of her striking appearance, anytime Irene would go to Mass, she was often noticed and approached by other parishioners, particularly men. Many times, husbands would find a silly reason to go strike up a conversation with her while their wives would watch and give them the death stare. Obviously awkward for Irene, too, I imagine.
Isn't that a bunch of bullshit, though?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. I know that they're saying vanity is a sin, but how is what someone else's feelings are? Like, how is that our fault? And that's where we don't have to take responsibility for that. And I feel like growing up Catholic, that was always like your shame, you know?
But I remember that too, growing up Catholic. Now, I didn't grow up in the time that she was going to church, but even when I was growing up Catholic, there'd always be creepy dudes out there doing creepy things. And of course, if there's an attractive woman there, they think that they have to talk to her because
Bunch of fucking animals.
Yeah. And that... And that was the case with her, too. And as with any church in those days, there was always gossip, and she had to deal with that. But in hindsight, it can be viewed as a good thing of sorts that Irene was often the center of attention, as several parishioners remembered seeing her there that night.
People pay attention.
They do, yeah. And Irene had told her parents that she would be coming back home straight away after Mass and confession. But as the night continued, she still hadn't arrived, leading them to become extremely worried, as any parent would be. Remember, this is decades before everyone had a form of instant communication in their pocket. So if you didn't show up at home when you said you would be there, there was really no way of getting a hold of that person, save for calling around other people on the landline of the telephone and asking them. And by all accounts, that's what her parents did, but to no avail. Finally, they became so distressed that they got in the car at 3 o'clock in the morning and drove straight to the McAllen police station where they reported Irene missing. The largest volunteer search for a missing person to that date ensued in the city of McAllen. And initially, they came up with nothing, at least in the first day. However, day two of the search provided a few striking clues, as Irene's purse was discovered, along with her left shoe and a lace veil that she was wearing the night of her disappearance. And I had to look this up, and this certainly, at least as far as my knowledge, is not the case at Catholic churches anymore. But back then, when a woman would go to confession, she would actually wear a veil.
Mm-hmm. You can see them on like old hats.
Yeah. Yeah. So
you like pull it down.
Mm-hmm. And that's what they found, along with her shoe and her purse. This was also around the time when Irene's parents got a phone call from a woman claiming to be Irene, who said she had been kidnapped and was being held against her will at a hotel in the nearby town of Hidalgo. And there was also a man who told a waitress at a restaurant that he himself was the one who killed Irene. However, both of these instances turned out to be hoaxes, as the woman who called Irene's parents was apparently playing a cruel joke on them, and the man who said he murdered Irene was drunk and just making up stories to impress the waitress, he said. That's not exactly a good way to hit on a woman, to tell her that you killed someone.
I reiterate, fucking animals. What the hell?
5 days after Irene went missing, her body was found. It was floating in a canal several miles from where that initial evidence was spotted. And upon post-mortem examination, investigators discovered that Irene had died from suffocation and had also been sexually assaulted after being beaten until she was no longer conscious. Which is...
what the fuck?
I know. Man. It's horrible to think about a person's last moments. Especially, I mean, anybody, but just getting to know her here and knowing how good of a person she was, it's just horrible to think about how her last moments must have been. And
at that point, you almost are grateful that they didn't make it.
Yeah.
That they did not have to live through the experience and then with the post-traumatic stress that can come from that.
Mm-hmm. And her face was bloodied, and she had two large bruises over both of her eyes. And unfortunately, any sort of evidence that investigators may have been able to gather, such as hair or blood or semen, was washed away in the canal. As we've said with other cases from this time period, there was no DNA testing at this time. It was a good 25 years away from being put into practice for forensics. Police began questioning everybody. In fact, over 500 individuals were questioned in the days after Irene's body was discovered. So initially, they were definitely doing their job. They spoke with Irene's family members, her coworkers, her ex-boyfriends, even registered sex offenders or suspected offenders in the area. No stone was left unturned here. A reward of $2,500 was offered to anyone with knowledge leading to an arrest, which was the biggest amount of money ever offered in the area at that time. Might not seem like that much now, but back then, $2,500, that was a lot of money. Later, a Texas businessman offered $10,000 for a reward. And while no major suspects were arrested, rumors began circulating around town about one individual. I don't know if you've ever been a part of this, but if there's, you know, a case that goes on in your local town, sometimes the townspeople know about it before the police do, or at least maybe they think they do. And there's always all kinds of gossip and rumors about things that happen in a town like this. And that's what was going on here, too. But who was this individual that they were talking about? Well, because of who he was, it has been argued that investigators were turning a blind eye to the evidence against him. And who was this individual? Well, it was none other than Father John Feit.
Fucking priest! I saw that coming. God damn it. Why is it always these disgusting priests?
I'm sorry. No.
No. Like a personal level of hatred for the... This is actually legitimately the reason I don't deal with the Catholic Church anymore.
Same.
It's because there is not enough handled with this shit.
Yep.
They take advantage of people who look to them gross.
And they've been doing it for decades upon decades. And we've seen so many instances of this. I mean, hell, there have been hundreds of cases of priests with molesting little boys, and then they get sent to another parish and it all gets swept under the rugs. And we're going to get into this a little bit more here. When I was researching this case and I found out that it was the priest that was being looked at as a suspect, sadly, I wasn't really surprised, just growing up Catholic. I'm like, okay, yeah. Well, you know, it's happened many.
Oh, look, another one.
Yeah. And he was a local priest. He was actually a visiting priest at Sacred Heart Church. And he was the man that Irene gave her final confession to. Partially,
I'm just thinking of this poor, beautiful woman who is ostracized for her looks. Mm-hmm. You know, that whole aspect of all of these angry wives because their husbands can't control themselves.
Yep.
Nobody can get their shit together. And then this poor young woman slips through the cracks and at the hands of someone that she trusted.
Yeah. Yeah, that she was giving confession to. You know, that's supposed to be the ultimate person you trust. I mean, growing up Catholic, I remember giving confession as a kid, and
that's vulnerable, you
you're
know?
You're very vulnerable at that point. Now, I didn't always tell him everything I had been doing.
There was a point when I really did. I really did tell them everything I was doing.
I don't think I ever did, to be honest.
Yeah, well, I also scored a little higher on the autism self-assessment, so I was like, I mean, some of these things make a little bit more sense, if that's accurate.
John Bernard Feit was 27 years old and had only been a priest in the church for a short period of time. It sounds like he had only recently completed his seminary training in San Antonio. After Irene's body was discovered, a few suspicious things came to light about Mr. Feit. Most notably, that the priest's slide viewer, which was a device that was used to view pictures back in the day, for our younger listeners, you know what I'm talking about, right? Like one of those ViewMaster things.
Mm-hmm.
So the slide viewer was found when they drained the canal. It was also reported by other priests that Feit had taken Irene to the rectory for her confession rather than the stall that is typically used for confession inside the church. Now, the rectory, for all intents and purposes, is where the priests reside. And I can say, as someone who grew up Catholic, I never once went into the rectory, nor do I know of anyone going in there who wasn't specifically involved with the church. I don't know about you. Did you ever go into a rectory?
No, I never did.
Thankfully, yeah. And
I feel like I would have been pretty uneasy.
Yeah. The priests would also report that Fite had several scratches on his hands and arms that were not noticed before Irene went missing. And you're probably thinking, well, this is pretty cut and dry. How does this go almost 60 years being unsolved? And we're going to get into that. But it was said that Fite was given a polygraph test, and investigators initially said that he passed it. But much, much later on, it was reported that the results were actually inconclusive. Fite also, at the outset, denied that he had taken Irene to the rectory for confession, but later he did admit to doing so. And it's like, okay, well, why'd you lie? Why'd you lie, buddy? What are you hiding? Well, when told by police that other priests had noticed his absence for several hours from the sanctuary, Fite explained that, well, I had broken my glasses and I drove to the church's pastoral house to grab another pair. And when I got there, I realized that I had forgotten my keys. So I had to climb up on the balcony to get inside. And that's how I got the scratches on my arms. And that's why I was so late. As far as excuses go, I don't know.
A whole lot of bullshit.
It's like, that's the best you came up with? Something else of note, Ryan, just 3 weeks before Irene was murdered, a woman by the name of Maria Guerrera was kneeling at the communion rail at another Catholic parish in McAllen when she was reportedly sexually assaulted. Now, apparently, rumors around town said that Fite was the one responsible for this, and these were shot down by local church leaders saying that there was no way a Catholic priest should ever even be considered for a crime so heinous. So they shot
they
that shit down.
They always cover that shit up. Yep. Oh my God.
And Fite himself.
I don't understand why these people who, this like moments like this where I actually go, you know what? I really do hope that there is something after you die. Because all of the things that you keep to yourself that you don't tell anyone about because you're so ashamed you did this horribly dark thing, and then no one ever finds out about it, like all these unsolved murders.
Yeah.
I hope you meet God at the end so that all your nasty shit gets, it's like we dump out the contents of that bag and we just observe.
And that's what I'm curious about, I guess, on another level that's kind of aside from this. I wonder, like, all of these priests who have been doing all of these heinous things over the years, do they believe in God? Because if they do, they should realize that, you know, I mean, when you go to meet your maker.
You know, anyone who kind of climbs the ladder to a position of power, they want something out of that. And it's not always from a place of good intentions. A lot of these people really like attention and power, and they like being, you know, looked at like they're such a good guy.
Yeah.
And then they're put in positions with these vulnerable people, mm-hmm. and the good
they take
ones
advantage.
Show themselves, and the bad ones
show themselves.
They take advantage.
And we should say there's plenty of great priests out there. In fact, I remember some pretty great priests from being a kid.
I remember one.
Yeah.
And I am a pretty good judge of character, so mm-hmm. I feel like he's one of the good guys.
Yeah.
But that's what I'm saying. It's like you don't always know who they are, who the ones are that are coming from a place of bad intentions.
Yep.
But sometimes they just make you feel a little bit nervous. And yeah. that's really important to pay attention to, because everyone has an intuition. And some of us get cut off from that by being gaslit or being told that we don't know what we're experiencing and we don't actually understand our emotions or our feelings, or we're cut off from them mm-hmm. by being told that they don't matter. But realistically, if that little gut feeling says, I don't know if I trust this situation, fucking stop right there. And just pay attention to what happens. Yep. Body language, verbiage, it all matters. And people show themselves in those little micro signals.
Oh, that was, this feels like catharsis, man. This is a good therapy session for us former Catholics here. I had no idea it was going to be like this.
I feel so bad for this woman, yeah. you know? Like, well, I understand that all of those, I can put myself in all of those situations and just recognize that at any point, the person on the other side of that screen could have taken advantage mm-hmm. of me. They could have.
And what's sad is not only was this woman taken advantage of, Irene Garza, but then these other people who didn't even have anything to do with her murder stood up for this guy and let it slide. And that's what we're going to get into a little bit more here. And Fight himself said that he had, in fact, been at the parish on the day of the assault of Maria Guerrera. But he said he was there visiting another priest, and he denied that he ever sexually assaulted her. Well, he was eventually charged with rape, and the case actually went to trial in 1962, which ended in a hung jury. But instead of heading into a second trial, this is when things start to get a little weird. Fight pleaded no contest later that year to a misdemeanor charge of aggravated assault, and he was ordered to pay a $500 fine. Many years later, Fight would say that he failed to understand that a plea of no contest would be an admission of guilt for the crime. After the legal proceedings with the Maria Guerrera case, the local diocese decided to ship Fight somewhere else, make him somebody else's problem.
Just sweep him under the rug. Oh, we don't want to deal with that.
And unfortunately, as we've gotten into, that was an all too common thing for the Catholic Church back then. So many times throughout the years, we've seen instances like this, particularly in regards to Catholic priests being accused of molestation. Then the local diocese sweeps it under the rug and ships the priest off to a new community far away where people have no knowledge of what transpired.
Yeah, and now he can just start his whole deal over and hurt somebody else.
That's exactly what happened with Father John Fight. And I couldn't believe this when I first read it. He was first sent to the New Mallory Abbey in my home state of Dubuque, Iowa for a while, and then to a monastery in Missouri. These were both monasteries for monks. So it was almost like a rehabilitation for him. The priests were trying to reform him and to send him off where he couldn't talk to anybody. He couldn't be anybody's problem for a while, and maybe he would get better. I think that was their...
No, you put that bitch in jail is what you do, because he is a danger to society.
And this is where the story really starts to piss me off even more. A local leader...
Oh, I'm already fired up. Bring it to me.
A local leader at the monastery directed one of his underlings to monitor Fight and see if he was still fit to serve the faith. And they were well aware of the charges against him, it was said. This monk named Dale Tackney would report to his superiors that Fight had confessed to him that he hurt a young lady and murdered another. But Tackney said that it was not his job to judge Fight at the time.
They knew. They knew the whole time, and they didn't do anything about it.
They knew. And this confession by Fight would go unreported to investigators for years and years and years. And Dale Tekeny would later give testimony that instead of giving her confession that night, well, Fight had pulled Irene Garza by the arm away from the confessional and took her to the church rectory, where he gagged her with a cellophane bag in a bathtub until she suffocated. And that's what he told Dale Tekeny. Just, it's so unbelievably frustrating that he actually did confess to the crime, which, by the way, does not happen with murders that much. There's a lot of murders out there, and we've covered a lot of these cases where, even though everybody knows they're guilty, till their dying day, they say they're innocent. He actually did confess. But this guy sat on the confession because it said it wasn't his job to judge. Who the hell's job is it? I don't understand that.
You know, we have a lot.
Oh.
This is a lot to unpack here, because when it comes to organized religion, what they do is they often create this air of subservience, right? Like, we're lesser than, we're lower than. And I feel like monks and priests, by the general population, get put onto this pedestal. Like, they're the best of the best. They're the purest humans that exist. And that's not true, because these are men. These are human people. And we all have our faults and our shortcomings, and not everyone can be trusted. I don't put my faith in men. But what I think is a misinterpretation, or maybe an intentional redirection of the meaning. When we say that we're created in God's image, we have been kind of under this perception of, like, we are created in the physical image of God. So we think of God as being like a person or an entity that has shape. But when we break it down and we actually think, well, maybe that in the image of God is actually the power to create and destroy, which is what we do as human beings. We create and we destroy. And so in that way, we have this godlike power, this godlike energy, and we can use it of our own free will. And it's like the test is if humanity can get its shit together and use that power to do good in the world, or do bad and destroy.
Right now we're failing that test.
I feel like that is the most accurate shit that could ever be stated, because as a collective, the people who have risen to power in this capitalist society that we have created, it's like, you know, the only people who are going to get to that point, the people in power, they're the ones who want to be there.
Yeah.
And there are a ton of us who are just like, you know, some asshole with a microphone, and we have no power to do anything but have a good impression on the people around us, like put out good intentions into our immediate surroundings. But that's like, that requires the echo to continue on and on and on. The ripple needs to go out, and everyone is responsible for their own free will and their own godlike energy and what they do with it in the world. And this man should be punished for, you know, like, people who do shit like this need to be punished. Unfortunately, we can't just cast them out because our society is too big and we've created the justice system the way it is.
Well, and
in a lot of ways, it helps people.
Yeah.
But it also is looking more and more like that's corrupt too, you know?
Mm-hmm. And it is, in this case, it certainly was corrupt, because, like we mentioned, there were a number of people that could have done something about this, that knew what he had done and just looked the other way, like this monk. And Fight didn't stay in Missouri for very long at this monastery, as he reportedly didn't enjoy the lifestyle of being a monk. Well, he was then sent to, and I believe, I'm not sure how to pronounce this, but I'll just take a crack at it. He was sent to Yemez Springs in New Mexico, which was a treatment facility of sorts for troubled priests. And it's funny because the public at large probably didn't even know this place existed, but it was there for a long time. And he eventually landed a supervisory role at the facility. And get this, he was in charge of placing quote unquote rehabilitated priests in new parishes. And one of these priests was a guy by the name of Father James Porter, who fight cleared for service at another church. And Ryan, Father James Porter would later be imprisoned for abusing as many as 100 children. I mean, it's just adding insult. Adding insult to injury here. I mean, just the worst. The worst. All in the name of God, too. That's what's the worst about this. But yeah, not only was Fite committing violent sexual assaults and even murder himself, but he was in charge of giving the green light to other perpetrators to do the same thing. And again, people wonder why so many have become disenfranchised with the Catholic Church. Well, that's another reason.
And evil walks among us.
Fite would eventually leave the priesthood altogether in the 1970s, and he would move to Phoenix, Arizona, get married, and have three children. He also landed a job with St. Vincent de Paul as a food charity volunteer for 17 years. And I tried to find out if his wife and the St. Vincent de Paul organization were aware of his shady past, but couldn't get any information on it. My guess is neither his work nor his wife knew anything about it, because why would he tell them? You know,
just keep starting over. Just keep moving. Just leave it all behind.
In a bit of redemption here, in 2002, after about 40 years, Dale Tacony decided that he could no longer keep the secret of Fite's confession. So
that's right, motherfucker. It's eating you alive, isn't it?
Yeah, probably because he was getting towards the end of his life.
Didn't want to go to God with that one on his chest.
Maybe that's what it was.
Gosh, it's just self-preservation. That's all it is.
That's exactly what it is. And he had thought that the murder had taken place in San Antonio because that's where John Fite had trained to become a priest. So Dale Tacony actually called authorities in San Antonio. The investigation into Irene Garza's death was then reopened that year. And an investigator who worked with the Texas Rangers named Rudy Yaramillo contacted a priest by the name of Father Joseph O'Brien. And he was a guy who had worked with Fite at the time of Irene Garza's death. O'Brien had told a TV program in the year 2000 that he didn't know anything about the murder, but he admitted to Yaramillo that John Fite had confessed to him as well shortly after it had taken place.
For real?
So yet another person that knew about it. And this was also 2002, when the polygraph examiner who had tested Father John Fite back in 1960 said that he reportedly questioned the results. Again, 40 years later. Why couldn't you have said this at the time? The examiner said that he kind of felt the entire time that Fite had failed this polygraph test. So many people that could have done something here, but... And then this also surprised me. Rene Guerrera, which is no relation to Maria Guerrera that we talked about earlier, was the district attorney of Hidalgo County from the 1980s all the way until 2014. Guerrera chose not to bring the Irene Garza case before a grand jury until 2004. Now, Dale Tacony and Father O'Brien and Fite also did not receive any subpoenas in the case, and the grand jury did not indict Fite as well. And just a side note, this Father O'Brien that we were talking about died in 2005, so later he wouldn't be able to give any testimony anyway. But Guerrera was said to be reluctant to revisit this case and said that the early police investigation had been a little bit iffy, and also this Father O'Brien was suffering from dementia when he was questioned, and there was no actual physical evidence against Father John Fite. Seems like a lot of excuses are being made here.
Yeah.
And Guerrera kind of pissed off Irene Garza's family by saying, quote, "Why would anyone be haunted by her death? She died. Her killer got away," end quote. Not exactly the district attorney that maybe you're hoping for.
Yeah, literally, what the fuck?
So in 2014, a district court judge named Ricardo Rodriguez actually campaigned against this Guerrera as district attorney, and the Garza case became one of the campaign issues in the election. Rodriguez had said that he wanted justice for Irene Garza's family, and he also said that he would take a new look at this case if he were elected. So the case was reopened, and in February of 2016, John Fite was arrested in Scottsdale, Arizona. At the time of his arrest, he was 83 years old, and he was using a walker when he appeared in court. That also angers me, because he was able to live his entire life almost without any repercussions. But he was extradited to Texas in March of 2016 and was incarcerated at the Hidalgo County Sheriff Adult Detention Facility. He entered a plea of not guilty, and the prosecution requested a $750,000 bond. And it was interesting because I actually watched a video of his arrest, and he was kind of going back and forth as to why the bond had to be that high. I don't think he got it at that point. I don't think it had clicked to him what was about to happen, that justice was finally about to be served. But when he actually asked for the bond to be lowered, the judge actually upped the bond to $1 million. Unfortunately, Fite wasn't going to be around much longer anyway, because at the time of his arrest, he had stage 3 kidney and also bladder cancer. During the trial, and this one, Ryan, might take the cake, because this is where it all gets revealed. During the trial, it was revealed by the prosecution that a deal had been struck between law enforcement, local leaders, and the Catholic Church to keep Fite's crime from the general public. And this wasn't just speculation on the prosecution's part, Ryan. They produced a letter as evidence of this. And in the letter, dated October of 1960, it raised concerns with that November's election. Because you see, in 1960, a guy by the name of John F. Kennedy was running to become the first Catholic ever elected to the presidency of the United States. And back then, it was a big deal, because there were people saying, oh, we can't have a Catholic as president. Can we trust a Catholic as president? Which is ridiculous to think about now, but that was some of the talking points back then. So the local leaders and the Catholic Church were worried that a high-profile murder case would quite possibly hurt Kennedy's chances at becoming president. So they made a deal with the DA, and that deal was that if Fite pled guilty to the sexual assault of Maria Guerrera, they would drop any and all charges in the Irene Garza case and ship him off to a monastery somewhere. And that's exactly what ended up happening. Makes
you
sick.
You've got to be kidding me.
A conspiracy unmasked, you know?
Well, and it really highlights the fact that women of color are not looked at with the same concern as anybody else.
Mm-hmm. And it makes
the amount of Latina, Black, all of the in between, the women that go missing.
Indigenous women. Yeah.
Holy shit. The numbers on this stuff is insane. Medical profession, even writing off the pain of women who are people of color, who are just of no consequence to them.
Yep.
And it just pisses me the fuck off when it's, the Catholic Church, number one, and this woman just, we're just going to sweep everything under. No one's going to care.
Yeah.
She's dead. The killer got away. What the hell?
Well, and it also makes you wonder how many other shady deals like this have happened in the past that we know nothing about. That's why
you need to keep church and state separate, because this sort of thing happens.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be allowed. Unfortunately, our society is just way too big. Our populations as a whole are way too big. We have to follow the same fucking rules. Does not matter what your preferences are. And unfortunately, the reason that we can't just drag these assholes out into the street and lynch them the way that they used to is because people get accused of shit that they haven't actually done.
Yeah. I mean, look at the Salem witch trials,
Yeah, seriously. We're just gonna, she's a witch.
She's a witch. Let's kill her,
She knows too much is what that fucking means. God damn right. it.
Yeah, it does make you wonder though. And that's why it's important for us to keep talking about this. Because it's good to bring stuff like this to light, to let everybody know that things like this happen, and to remember it so we don't repeat this kind of stuff, because history does have a way of repeating itself. And
I'm wearing this sweatshirt, and I love this sweatshirt. It just says be a good human.
Aww.
And I feel like everybody should just do that. Be a good human. Be a person who tells the truth, who is honest, modest, and humble. And just level of self-awareness. If everybody respected everybody and we could just talk through shit, God. And then there are just these monsters out there that are just walking. It's probably your neighbor.
I feel like my cat is a better human than most humans. Honestly.
That's why you live alone with the cat. Because
and she bites me all the time.
She's keeping you in line. That's really what that is. Animals are better than us, I feel.
Yeah. So on December 7th, John Feit was convicted of Irene Garza's murder. Finally, December 7th.
But he lived his whole life comfortable with all of that.
2017, Feit's attorney actually asked that he be given probation. And the reason he said was because he had never been convicted of any sort of felony or other convictions since Garza's death. The prosecution asked for a sentence of 57 years, which was symbolic because that's how many years had passed since Irene Garza's death. But on December...
I agree.
I thought that was pretty fitting. And it was on December 8th of 2017... that the jury pronounced a sentence of life in prison. Well, life in prison didn't last very long. Feit was incarcerated about 10 miles north of Huntsville, Texas, and he died of natural causes on February 12th of 2020. So 2.5 years, about a little less. Yeah. But... That's why I said in the beginning, it's kind of bittersweet in a sense, because justice was ultimately served and we got our guy, but there was a lot of bullshit to go through to get there. And it could have been right away. I mean, there was the evidence. I told you about the Viewmaster thing that was found there, the scratches on him and the fact that he confessed to multiple people, and yet he was able to walk Prix for 57 years. Frustrating.
Yeah. Like I said, moments when you're just like, man, I really do hope that you meet your God when you die, because you should have to answer for that shit. And maybe that, you know, like, I don't know, that probably makes me not a good person. But I think that
wait a minute. You're wearing the be a good human sweatshirt.
I know. Here, I know. But I also feel like, you know, like, I'm not spiritual and all love and light to the extent where I'm going to forgive everyone for the shit that they do. When you bring harm intentionally to another living thing without any, I mean, and it's like, I don't even know how you could justify it, because if someone tried to hurt my kids, you bet I'd probably go to prison for what I would do.
Yep.
But I feel like it's really important that we keep people in line, because what else, like, how do you stand for anything if you don't put your foot down and say, no, I'm not okay with this fucking behavior.
And nobody is above the law, including
and it's like people when there's in positions moments, of even power. Even if you're standing in line and you are witnessing the person in front of you verbally abusing another human being.
Yeah.
And you could step in and say something, and you just kind of, I'm just going to mind my own fucking business. It's like, what do you stand for?
Or if you, there was a time very recently where I was walking to my car in my parking garage, and I saw what I thought could be a domestic assault situation, and I called the police, you know,
because as you should.
You just can't take the chances, you know.
Right. And with what you know, with what you have read, what you research all the time, it's like you can't just ignore the signs.
Yeah, know? They didn't unless, know that a like, true crime podcaster was walking by, that's for sure.
Probably not. You're not like advertising or anything. Just had, some guy.
Had he known, he probably would have kept his voice down, I'm guessing. This kind of feels like therapy right now, what we're doing here. This feels like a little therapy session. I love it.
I think that most human conversations should kind of be like that, you know? Like, if we're talking about things and we both walk away like, that was kind of nice. That's how conversation should be. Not like, oh, yeah, it wouldn't be so bad if it weren't for the wind. That's all we talk about. Surface level shit.
Right.
Just we keep it all right here. If I never have to deal with it, I'll die and it'll just dissipate.
A lot of people are like that.
I know.
So if you would like to talk more about this case, and if you think justice was served, or if it should have happened decades earlier, you can always reach out to us on our socials, and you can find us at Unnatural the Podcast on Instagram. Check us out on Facebook, Unnatural a True Crime Podcast, or send us an email, unnaturalthepodcast@gmail.com. Make sure to like, follow, and rate us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you get your podcasts from Google Podcasts, by the way, we just got word that Google Podcasts is no more at the end of March. So find us on another one of the streaming services. So many of you may be wondering how Emily's doing. Well, she's doing great. So great that apparently now she's a published author. Did you see this, Ryan?
I did. I've been following the progress. So amazing. Excited.
So she has a book, and you can find it on Amazon. And the book has a very interesting title. It's called Behind Someone Else's Door. I love the illustration on this, too. This
it gives neat. Lord of the Rings vibes.
Ooh, yeah, it does kind of. And it's a collection of poetry by Emily, and she goes by E.J. Lee. So we would love it if you would check out her new poetry, and you can find it on Amazon. Just search Behind Someone Else's Door, and it's only $10. So it's a really cheap way to find out what's going on with her. And she's an amazing wordsmith. So this would be cool to read.
It's already got 5 stars.
Ooh. Yeah, we got to give it some 5 stars. Give it some love here. And we'll put a link in our show notes too, so you guys can check it out. And by the way, Emily is going to be joining us again very soon for our 3-year anniversary. 3 years of talking about murder.
That's fantastic.
Unbelievable. It's amazing. In fact, I was kind of throwing this around and I hadn't discussed it with you yet, Ryan, but let's see if you're interested. So at some point this summer, maybe I will be swinging by your guys' area and we could do like a, I almost said threesome. We could do. So that's
I'm
why.
I'm so glad you at least said it out loud, but damn.
But you know what I mean.
We get along, but.
Let's not go that far here.
I know Emily separately from this, so.
I don't know what the hell you guys do in your recording time here, but count me out. No, but I was thinking that maybe all three of us could get together and like record an episode together. I thought that might be fun at some point.
Yeah, that would be fun. I don't know. It would be interesting. Might feel like a third wheel, you know.
No. But oh my God, no.
I'll watch.
You'll watch. That's going to be in the bloopers. Okay. On that note, be sure to make good choices.
And don't get got.
Today, Ryan, we are heading to the very southern tip of the U.S. In the... Why did I word it this way? Hold on.
Just the tip.
Yeah, just the tip. There's a lot of bent up sexual innuendos in my notes these days. Look, it's been a while since I had a girlfriend. Apparently it's coming through in my writing now.
Oh my God. Psychologists would have a field day with you.
Right. How do you feel about your mother? Anyway, okay. All right. Let me rephrase this. Okay. Have you ever been to Texas, by the way?
No.
They always say everything's bigger there. I don't know if that's true or not, but it is a big state. I know that. And there's a lot of different things going on in Texas, a lot of different culture there too. I'd always want to see it myself, but we're going to a city that straddles the U.S.-Mexico border and the Rio Grande River. No, what? It straddles?
You said everything is bigger in Texas, and then you're like, what the fuck is happening right now?
No, that's what they say about Texas. Google everything's bigger in Texas. Like that's a saying.
And that it straddles.
See, now you're gonna be looking for little things in everything I say.
I am.
Oh God.
Maybe it's me. Maybe it's my problem.
This is gonna be a theme in today's podcast. I feel like
I'm the problem.
And we are just getting started, so who knows where it's gonna go from here. But
I'm sorry.
Okay, no,
I get my shit together.
I encourage you to keep doing this. Okay.
That honest, that it's like, even I'm honest, really raw honest with myself.
Like when you thought that it was me putting all these sexual innuendos in here and then you realized maybe it was you.
I'm the one seeing dicks everywhere. It's not I see dead people, it's I see dicks.
Oh God, we need to remake that movie with Bruce Willis while he's still alive.
Oh, the fact that he's, oh, that poor man.
That's actually,
I can't,
really sad.
I can't make fun of him. Yeah.
No, but I just like thought of a scene in my head with like you next to Bruce Willis where you're like, I see dicks.
It's just through,
and then his facial expression's like, what did you just say? In the nearby town of Hidalgo, yeah, Renee was actually the district attorney of Hidalgo. Oh, why can't I say that word?
It was a movie, Hidalgo.
That's right, it was a movie.
Are you intrigued by the dark side of things like murder, kidnapping, and sex cults? What about when the criminal is your favorite musician or actor or director or writer? Hollywood might look like all glitz and glamour until you take a closer look. But I'll tell you one thing, that kind of point of view can make you more vulnerable. From Roman Polanski to Mackenzie Phillips to Judith Barcy to Kurt Cobain, some are predators and some are prey. I'm Dee Dee West, and I just might ruin your childhood. Follow my podcast, Broken Limelight, where I cover celebrity true crime stories. For more information, visit BrokenLimelight.com. Again, that's Broken Limelight. Follow it on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or anywhere you listen to your favorite podcasts.